Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, our guest argues that there are much better ways of understanding the processes and politics of patronal systems. Then, on the Scholar Circle, historically, corporations were required to have a public purpose in order to exist. They were dissolved once they achieved that purpose. How did we get to where we are today, and what does it mean for democracy? While many in the West decry the politics of the former Soviet Union countries as corrupt and anti-democratic, our next guest argues that there are much better ways of understanding the processes and politics of patronal systems. Henry Hale is Associate Professor of Political Science and International Affairs and co-director of the Program on New Approaches to Research and Security in Eurasia. He's the author of Why Not Parties in Russia? Democracy, Federalism, and the State, Developments in Russian Politics, and his latest, Patronal Politics. Welcome, Henry Hale. It's great to have you here on the Scholar's Circle. Your new book, Patronal Politics, you've essentially proposed this kind of new way of understanding events in the world that we have generally, in academia especially, called democratization, rising authoritarianism, or revolution. You think it's really actually part of a longer pattern. What are you getting at?
Yes, I think the general idea is that in countries where you have high levels of corruption, low rule of law, where so much of politics as well, for that matter, as many other aspects of life, is about personal connections, who you know, that sort of thing, politics tends to work differently than it does in the West, for example. And I think that has big implications for the trajectories of countries in terms of their regime type and where they're going and patterns of politics. And so one of the broader conclusions is that when you have this sort of social environment where everything really depends on who you know and the personal connections and pressures that are put on individuals to vote a particular way through these personal connections or rewards that might be doled out on an individual basis, what you tend to get is a kind of cycling in politics. And so you get situations where when personal connections are important to power in order to have any resources or to have protection from others who might threaten you, there tends to be a rally around the leader type effect that tends to facilitate people who want to establish a more authoritarian form of rule, who want to quash their opponents. But at the same time, these sorts of systems, which might be compared to a giant political machine of the Boss Tweed variety, are vulnerable to, in particular, succession crises. So when people start thinking that this leader, this big patron, might be on his or her way out, then kind of all hell breaks loose. People start thinking about the future, trying to identify who the next patron will be, and trying to get on that person's side, or trying to become that person, or trying to prevent your rival from becoming that person. And so that leads to a breakdown. That's where I think you see a lot of the major revolutions in countries like this. So I focus on the former Soviet world. So we have the color revolutions that were largely described in media as being the products primarily of mass uprisings and democratic yearnings in the Orange Revolution in Ukraine, Rose Revolution in Georgia, Tulip Revolution in Kyrgyzstan. But I think these actually have much more to do with succession politics at the top. It opens up space for popular opinion to get expressed through these protests. And then the succession process gets played out. You get a new leader. But then almost inevitably, you start getting the same kind of reconsolidation of a more authoritarian system as all these people try to seek out their own personal connections with the people who have power and who have access to resources, because you can't rely on rule of law or independent courts to protect your interests. So you have to have this personal connection. And so the result is then a return back to more authoritarian rule until you have the next wave, the next succession crisis, which then tends to lead to more tensions. And I think the main way, in the short run at least, that in these countries can avoid this sort of cycling is to try and just maintain a high degree of popular support by trying to provide things that people genuinely want. When that tends to be the case, it reduces the fragmentation effect and gives leaders more control over the succession process. But even so, succession, is very fraught with risk for these leaders. So I think that's it in a nutshell in terms of what I think the core nature of many societies in the world, in particular in the former Soviet bloc, is, and some of the implications for how politics works and how we might understand it.
I wondered if, in fact, we're seeing a sort of continuum of patronal politics rather than one being, you know, absolutely patronal politics, and another being not so much, like you said, Western societies, because some of those characteristics that you described, and you mentioned Bastweed, but some of them are still to some degree present in, say, U.S. politics. You know, who you know really matters. The role of money really matters. Personal favors for donors does occur. So would you put this on a spectrum across the world, or would you say one is distinct from the other system?
Absolutely. This is not a situation where you have some societies that are completely patronalistic, which is the term I use to describe these societies that, you know, have a low rule of law, high corruption, strong role for personal connections, and societies that are non-patronalistic. I use these concepts more as kind of ideal types in the sense that Max Weber described, sort of, you know, simplifications that illustrate a certain truth, even though no country is perfectly adherent to the type. So in this particular case, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, certainly I'm at George Washington University in Washington, D.C., but I can see up close exactly how personal connections matter a lot in this town. But I think there are more generally some societies in which they just matter much, much more than they do in others, and matter to such a degree that they really overwhelm the presence of any kind of impartiality that might be present in, say, the court system or the rule of law. I would say that I think this situation where rulers rule by personal connections and people get things done through personal connections, you can think about it as the most natural way for government to be formed, going back to the original human communities where everybody did know each other. And then as societies expanded, governments expanded, that was the natural way for those rulers to start expanding their influence, was to work through people they knew, to kind of govern by, even when societies got too big for them to know everybody, they'd appoint their own personal representatives who would know the local people to rule themselves. And so I think the exceptions in world history have largely been those countries that have managed to some degree escape this. So, you know, that would be, you know, Western countries in particular, and, you know, some Asian countries now have made some progress in that regard. But again, none of them have completely escaped it. Again, in Washington, D.C., we still have political machines in many parts of the United States. And so this is not a completely either-or structure. But what I would suspect is that the countries where this matters the most, that are the most patronalistic, you'll start to see these most pronounced kinds of political swings and gyrations and real difficulties transitioning to a true liberal democracy with protection of rights. Whereas the other countries, you know, that have managed to escape this patronalism to at least some degree tend to have an easier time of it. And they've managed to make a political system that just works in a very different way. You know, when people feel more secure through the rule of law and through court systems, that they don't have to rely just on personal connections to protect themselves or to get anything done.
Perhaps one of the other distinguishing factors, say, from the West in some ways, are coercion and direct benefit that happens in these patronal systems. Would you say that's true? And if so, how would you describe how it works in the patronal system?
I think in societies, again, the ones that I have focused most on have been the former Soviet countries. The tendency is precisely to rule through these personal connections. And ideally, I think even for these rulers, I mean, they would like people to voluntarily go along with them and just to rely on rewards. But in practice, they tend to find it attractive as rulers to use some of these more coercive tools, right, which would be abuse of state organs for personal purposes. So it's very common in former Soviet states, as well as other parts of the world, of course, for rulers to rely on their secret services, their police organs, to repress individuals, to collect information about individuals that can then be used for blackmail, arresting opponents. They can use control over budgetary resources to squeeze people that they don't like, people that are challenging the regime might suddenly find their donors subjected to tax inspections and fire inspections and all kinds of licensing problems that might hinder their ability to do business. So there's just a whole range of these kinds of activities that, again, involve these very personalized, targeted punishments as well as rewards for the loyal that help bolster the ruler's power. And I find that one of the interesting things about these societies is you often get people who come to power, sometimes through revolution, sometimes otherwise, who seem genuinely to want to change the system. But oftentimes what they find is they face a lot of opposition, partly just because any leader is going to have some sort of opposition to whatever they're trying to do. They don't tend to like this opposition, so it just becomes too tempting to use these sorts of powers. I mean, I think of Mikhail Saakashvili in Georgia, who was Western educated, had a degree from Columbia, came to power in Georgia, topped the Rose Revolution. So I think he, like many other leaders, found it more attractive to try and use some of these powers for good, you know, for the sake of good reforms, in his view, than to forego them. But the result is that using them, they kind of generate their own reality and reconstitute some of these bad practices that then make a country more closed and a more authoritarian place. So after coming to power, he was able to reduce corruption in some areas, a truly dramatic reform of the police, the traffic police system in particular, which was notorious for bribe-taking, now is almost entirely clean. It's just a striking reform that even his enemies, politically and otherwise, acknowledge. But at the same time, within a couple of years of the revolution, he found himself taking control over opposition media, ordering police to crack down a few years after the Rose Revolution on a massive opposition protest, and otherwise putting the squeeze on opposition increasingly. So it just became a much more closed place than it had been after the revolution. And I think that's symptomatic. I think there are, you know, many other examples that one could find of rulers, just even ones that want to do good things, want to create democracy, want to reduce corruption, just find these patronalistic levers of power too useful or too attractive in their context, where everybody expects that they will, these levers will be used anyway, too attractive to forego.
You mentioned that it's expectation that drives this, because everybody expects this.
To a certain degree. In societies, part of the reason why patronal politics, as I've called it in the book, is so persistent over time is because if everybody is engaging in this kind of activity, right, if everybody thinks that in reality it's more about who you know than about who's right and or wrong, say, before the law, you don't expect the law to be impartially enforced, then there's just a very strong temptation and even a moral argument that people can make that they have to play by those same rules. Because if you're the only person that tries to behave honestly and everybody else doesn't, odds are good it's not going to be very good for you. And that may be okay for you personally, right, if you're willing to be the odd person out. But what if it also affects your family, if you're the person unable to bring home the bacon, right? If you have people who depend on you and the only way to get something done that would help you, you know, provide good things is to go through these personal connections and maybe pay a bribe to get something done, then people generally tend to find that they have to do it. And so when everybody expects everybody else to do it, it makes their own individual decision to do it much easier, whereas it could change entirely if they expected that everybody was going to play by a different set of rules. And I think that's one of the great achievements of Western societies, is that it's been accomplished that most people expect other people not to blatantly subvert the law. And when people do that, you know, which they do continue to try, right? We still have corruption cases. There's a widespread feeling that, you know, risk that people might be caught or that this is just morally wrong. So there's enough of this expectation that this is not going to succeed that the behavior often gets caught and actually punished.
Let's turn to elections. I loved how you said this in the first part of the book. Elections are civil wars fought by nonviolent means. The opposite of what other political scientists have said about politics.
Right.
How is this the case?
I think on one hand, we tend to think, especially in Western societies, democracy sort of as what in the American context we think of as the New England town meeting, where we have citizens coming together and voicing different views, and then the broader public decides one way or other. You know, whereas in fact, I think in a lot of history, including much of the history of the United States, what we've seen is that elections are the arena not simply for a hashing out of views, but for a competition of different political forces, because especially when you get a society that's more than just, again, a small town where everybody can know each other and actually hear each other's views, somehow all the views that exist in society have to get aggregated and hashed out, and it's impossible for everybody's ideas to get heard. And so then which ideas do get heard and which don't? Well, that's a situation that involves resources and power. who can get their ideas onto the agenda, get their ideas voted on, get their ideas heard by the population. And then you have the situation where, in order to decide, what matters really is a turnout issue. How can you get your voters to the ballot box? Even in Western societies, right, that's an issue, and it's a situation that makes the administrative apparatus very important. Parties in the United States that can mobilize turnout, right, that can provide the buses and have the call centers to, you know, mobilize their supporters or physically bring them to the polls matters a lot. But in paternalistic societies, this just the paternalistic power aspect of it just becomes much more important, and it just becomes a much more organized battle that starts to blend over into the coercive or even sometimes violent. And so I think that's why if civil war is kind of the most violent way of resolving a political conflict within a country, completely devoid of rational debate over issues, elections are sort of the most peaceful way. In paternalistic societies, again, where I think rule of law is it's not completely absent, but it's not reliable, you start getting these battles, which are both the battles for hearts and minds, but they're also very much a battle of political machines, which means trying to suppress other voices, trying to project your own voice. And for the strongest political machines, of course, they can pretty much squelch other voices. And in the most extreme cases, actually force the voters out, really, so you're just falsifying results. But I think what's interesting is even in those societies where it's not a complete dictatorship or a monarchy, what formally decides the result of the battle is that you have to get an official election result somehow. And even a completely falsified election result is not easy to achieve. It's something that has to be mobilized. You have to have a huge administrative apparatus that's capable of organizing it, suppressing popular opposition, manipulating the party system in ways that is going to facilitate that. And so even that completely engineered election is a kind of Herculean administrative defeat that kind of resembles the movement of a large army to try and achieve its goals. And so they might not have to fire on the opposition side. They might not have to mow them down in organized battles. But there is that coercive element there. I mean, that would be another case where I think there is sort of a continuum in the level of coercion that's involved in the electoral process. And many of the countries of the world are kind of in that area in between, that kind of, some scholars have called it a gray area or a kind of twilight zone where, you do have some battle for real ideas, but a lot of the battle is a battle of these political machines.
You also wrote about a formal versus an informal kind of politics. How do you distinguish this informal aspect?
Well, when you talk about formal politics, I mean, formal politics is generally, the politics that are completely according to the way that laws appear on paper, the ways that they're formalized in legislation, if all law is perfectly obeyed. Informal politics is sort of the politics of the wink, of the mutual understanding that's concluded. And sometimes these unwritten rules, these informal rules, can be very developed and elaborate. Like mafia groups are a classic example of kind of informal politics governing them, right? I mean, there's a clear hierarchical structure. Everybody understands how it works, or if you don't understand, you're eliminated pretty quickly, or you're brought into line. But none of that is actually written down. And so informal politics then, I think, is this kind of whole realm of politics that it works through these types of understandings. And so in most countries, highly paternalistic countries, again, like the former Soviet Union, you have some role for formal politics. I mean, there are laws that are passed, laws that are enforced by the police. But then so much of politics occurs off the books, so much that you can't even really understand how politics works if you don't understand the informal aspects, the unwritten rules of the game, who needs to be acknowledged when, what kinds of resources the different powers have, right? So, oligarchs, for example, these politically active business people, right, that can control massive corporate conglomerates, they have a very explicit political role in systems, for example, like Vladimir Putin. So, they're not in the government. They have no formal constitutional role, But they understand that in order to keep their business opportunities alive, they have to not run afoul, at a minimum, of Putin, and perhaps better, please him. And so they serve these roles of providing money and channeling money to forces that tend to work for the Kremlin, stifling financial opportunities of parties or individuals who might be, you know, doing things that the government doesn't like. And so, again, you know, that's an example of an informal political role, but this very important for understanding how the larger political system works. So, you know, Russia's political system is not like they just passed a law saying all opposition are banned. You know, there's no such law. But there's an informal understanding that those groups that do openly challenge the Kremlin are going to find going to have a very hard time, you know, in business, raising money, doing almost anything that they want to do, at least, you know, if these opposition forces are serious enough, the Kremlin is concerned about them. If they're just small fry, you know, they may just leave them alone.
We will continue next week with Henry Hale. Henry Hale is Associate Professor of Political Science and International Affairs and co-director of the Program on New Approaches to Research and Security in Eurasia. He's the author of Patronal Politics. Once upon a time, corporations were required to have a public purpose to operate in the United States. How did the system become what it is today? Next on the Scholar Circle. Stay tuned. You are listening to The Scholar's Circle, and I'm your host, Maria Armudian. Back in the late 18th century, corporations were required to have a public purpose. Then they were dissolved once they completed that purpose. Today's corporate model is quite different, where the purpose is profit alone. And alongside these changes, the corporation's power has grown immensely. How did we get here, and what is the effect on important matters like democracy? We are joined by three experts. Richard Abrams is a professor of history at University of California at Berkeley and the author of America Transformed, 60 Years of Revolutionary Change, 1941 to 2001. Paul Pearson is also with us. He is a professor of political science at University of California at Berkeley. He has written numerous books, including Winner Take All Politics, the latest, as well as Off Center, The Republican Revolution and the Erosion of American Democracy. We also have with us Scott Bowman. Scott Bowman is the chair of the political science department at Cal State University in Los Angeles, and he is the author of The Modern Corporation and American Political Thought, Law, Power, and Ideology. Richard Abrams, you and I first met when I worked in the California legislature, and you came and testified talking about the history of corporate power and how that affected American politics, starting really back in this time when corporations were created to serve a public purpose and then dissolved. And now it's evolved into something else. Talk about how this has evolved and how it relates to corporate law and the position of American corporations in American politics now.
You go back to the beginnings, which we're talking about, the late 18th and early 19th century. A corporation as a form of business organization, which is a creature of the state, and that's something one should always remember.
Clarify what you mean by creature of the state.
Corporation doesn't exist except when, by legislative authority, it is given a charter. Well, it used to be to do some very specific things. And the point that you're making about the corporation as having originally been serving public purpose is that the state would authorize, franchise a group of business people for the purpose of mobilizing capital, giving certain protection to the owners of the firm, of the entity, in order to encourage investment in a particular function that has public usefulness for which private enterprise by itself was not likely to have the resources, and government in particular in the 19th century, when there were very few sources of revenue, the government did not have the resources to achieve. So your original corporations tended to have to do with public utility kind of things, building of bridges, of roads, and eventually getting into banks and into mining facilities. And that was because there were not enough government resources to do that sort of thing by itself. So they franchised private enterprises to mobilize capital for that kind of purpose. The idea of it as serving a public function was specified usually in the charters. That is, the charters specifically said what exactly the business entity was supposed to be doing. But as the 19th century went on, and the major function and the major purpose of public policy was to encourage economic growth, then gradually the corporations came to be justified not solely on a basis of serving a public function, but simply to be making money, to be profitable, so that they could carry on and contribute, most important, contribute to economic growth in general. And over time, by the end of the 19th century, the requirement that the charter hold the corporation to some specific purposes tended to disappear. Its main function, as Friedman liked to say, was to make money, was to be profitable. That's what it was there for, and in that way contributed to the general welfare. And you get into the 20th century, and by the early 20th century, people are worried about the enormous amount of money that is, in fact, being mobilized by these entities, particularly as they go public, which is to say that they can advertise and sell portions, parcels of their ownership to the general public on a stock, what we call a stock exchange. And so there was a concern about how that might influence politics and diminish democracy, the democratic process. So a number of pieces of legislation were put into effect, including in 1907, limitations on how much money a corporation, or in fact banning the use of corporate funds for election purposes. In effect, that was what was completely nullified by the Supreme Court decision in Citizens United, where it said a corporation is a person and therefore can't be deprived of First Amendment free speech rights.
Maybe that's the perfect place to bring in Scott Bowman, because Scott Bowman, you have looked at this through the eyes of the courts as well as legislation and lobbying, and you and I have spoken over 15 years or something about these matters. The personhood issue is one of the big cases. Why don't you talk about this evolution that you've seen in the court and kind of the key cases that you think have led to Citizens United?
The Supreme Court acknowledged that the corporation, in effect, is a person for purposes of First Amendment rights. But before this, going back to the Bilotti case in 1978, the court had extended such rights really to the corporation for purposes of independent expenditures in elections that did not go to candidates but were just spent during the election cycle itself. It never actually squarely addressed the issue of whether the corporation was a person for First Amendment purposes. Most people aren't aware of the fact that the corporation has had First Amendment rights for some time now. It's this more recent case that brought it to the fore precisely because it struck down a case, the Austin case, which was decided in 1990, that limited the corporation's ability to spend directly in candidate elections. I guess I should clarify what's going on here, because the election law, the Federal Election Campaign Act, which gave rise to all of this law, is actually fairly complex as interpreted by the courts. And there's a basic distinction that was established in the Buckley case in 1976, and that is that the court imposed restrictions on contributions to candidates, which are still in place, and that applies to contributions from individuals, corporations, and unions. On the other hand, it did not impose the same restrictions on independent expenditures at that time, because expenditures were deemed not to have a corrupting influence on elections, as were direct contributions. That's always been a controversial distinction, and many members of the court never fully agreed with that distinction. What happens in Austin case is that the court imposes, or upholds rather, a restriction in Michigan law that prevented corporations and unions from contributing to candidates in candidate elections as expenditures, not contributions. What happened in Citizens United is that Austin was overturned. So what that amounts to is that now corporations and unions are free to spend as much as they want in candidate elections, although they're still not allowed to make contributions beyond the federally prescribed limitations. But it doesn't really matter about that limitation anymore, because they can funnel money in the millions to any candidate they want through various organizations. And that's what's happened with that, is that, of course, much of this is undisclosed, and in the future, millions and millions of dollars will be spent in candidate elections, and for some people it will completely subvert the purpose of the election reform, precisely because there will be sort of an unequal distribution of income or resources in candidate races. So that's really the backdrop of the more recent changes.
You've mentioned two things that I think are important to tie in now for our audience. One is really the effect that we're seeing on equality, and the other is the effect that we're seeing on democracy as a result of this kind of evolution that's been going on over the past couple of centuries. And as I understand from all of your work, that it's really accelerated over the last 50 years, and especially the last probably 35, 40 years, this kind of erosion of democracy and erosion of equality. Paul Pearson, I think we should bring you in on this to kind of bring this all together. Now, Scott Bowman, you mentioned the thing about labor unions and corporations both being able to spend, but labor unions have been, through various legislative processes, really weakened. So, Paul Pearson, pull this all together for us.
It's a huge topic, so I'm not sure I can pull it all together, but just to add a few points, I do think that in many ways the Citizens United decision, as dramatic as it is more a symptom of a much broader transformation that's taking place than in itself a fundamental shift in the politics. Because, as you were saying, Maria, there has been over the last, I would say since the late 70s, mid to late 70s, there's been a dramatic shift in the balance of political power and organized presence in American politics in favor of the affluent and business in particular. And Citizens United is just one symptom of that that comes at the end of a long process, which has involved both, as you mentioned, increasing inequality, but an increasing prominence of the role of business in American politics. You could tell a story about Citizen United that would link to that by saying, well, why is the Supreme Court making that kind of decision? Well, part of the reason is because over the last 20 or 30 years, conservatives have put enormous energy into trying to refashion the Supreme Court in directions that are going to be more favorable to business interests. There's been some interesting research on this lately showing that the Supreme Court has been getting much more conservative on economic issues, and it's also been paying much more attention to economic issues. And, of course, it's mostly Republican appointees who have been advancing that agenda, though they've been strongly encouraged by a number of organized groups that have tried to really push the legal process in this direction. The Chamber of Commerce, in particular, has been very active on these issues. So that's one example of what I think you would see if you looked at a lot of different aspects of American politics over the last 30 years, whether it's the courts or the legislature or regulatory agencies or the media. You would see a much more aggressive push in favor of the interests of the most organized parts of American business.
Paul Pearson, you in your book have actually broken out how bad the inequality has become. Can you give us a sense of what the numbers tell us?
I should just mention my co-author, Jacob Hacker. We published a book last fall called Winner Take All Politics. And the change in inequality, which is central to what we're looking at, is stunning over the last 30 years. There's been a more than doubling of the income share of the top 1%. There's been a more than quadrupling of the income share of the top 10th of 1%, the truly wealthy in American society. And while economists often suggest that this is just a result of globalization or technology or natural economic forces, we argue in the book that there's a lot of evidence to suggest that American politics has played a really critical role in bringing this about. And one piece of evidence suggesting that that's the case is the fact that you don't see the same kind of incredible concentration of income taking place in most other successful economies, most other affluent democracies. There's something quite distinctive going on in the United States, and politics is a big part of that.
Now, you mentioned the Chamber of Commerce being a big part of this. Scott Bowman, you've looked very hard at another one of the organizations, the Economic Roundtable. Tell us about this one.
That's the Business Roundtable. Before I talk about that, I just want to add to what Paul said, and there's a recent study done by the Constitutional Accountability Center, and it shows that on the Roberts Court, 68% of the time, when the chamber is arguing a case, it has won. And it compares that to the Burger Court, and the numbers are striking. Only 46% of the time did the chamber win when its case is before the court. That supports what he's suggesting. And it's clear that the justices have been picked for their political views as well. and, I mean, their pro-business views. Now, as far as the Business Roundtable goes, this is an organization that was formed in the early 70s in response to the rising tide of social legislation, and it was really originally formed out of groups, a couple of different groups that were going after labor. It was really kind of a movement afoot in the corporate community, but the Business Roundtable developed into a much more comprehensive organization, and it's really stunning in its effect. It consists of about the top 200 CEOs in the United States, and I guess they elect a new chairman every 2 or 3 years, and it is divided into issue-oriented task force that actually lobby senators and representatives. So it's actually CEOs that are doing the lobbying. But even more significant is the fact that the CEO, rather the chair of the roundtable himself, has access to the White House on a regular basis. The last 30 or 40 years has been what some analysts refer to as the political mobilization of business, has led to an increasing influence of large corporations through direct political activity, particularly lobbying. And this kind of lobbying, I think, is even more impressive than just the amount of money that's spent, because it's really about access. And just to give you an example, the chair of the roundtable wrote something or released several messages in the press being highly critical of Obama's policies on a variety of fronts. Within a matter of months, the Obama administration responded to the chair, began to moderate its policies in basically every area that the Business Roundtable has criticized. It's not a coincidence. Of course, you could argue that Obama is doing this to move to the center for electoral purposes, but it's very clear that the roundtable has tremendous influence.
Just a reminder that you are listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're speaking with Richard Abrams, Paul Pearson, Scott Bowman about how corporations were required to have a public purpose to operate in the United States. How did the system become what it is today? And Richard Abrams, let's bring you back in. One of the things you've looked at is kind of the result of this on basic public policies and also on the public tax structure and how much the shift in tax laws and the burden of financing public goods has occurred as a result of this kind of political activity in the courts. Talk to us about what that result has been.
I think that you can't legitimately talk about a Reagan revolution. Although the Business Roundtable was organized in the early 1970s, its avowed purpose was, in fact, to have the leaders of business corporations use their influence in their own political environments, considering that by the 1970s, the conglomerate movement had moved many of these firms into a multitude of different industries. That meant that in many different venues, the corporate leaders would devote their energies to influencing political or policy decisions. Now, that was really new by that time because, for the most part, CEOs did not themselves directly get involved in politics. They left that to lobbyists whom they hired. I'm not saying they weren't interested in political and policy outcomes, but they did not personally get so involved in it as they began to do in the early 1970s. So you could say there's already a transformation that's taken place in which corporate America has become self-consciously and deliberately involved in policymaking to the extent of their power, which is not inconsiderable. The Reagan Revolution, though, included this business about the changes in the Supreme Court. It's interesting that most of the biographies of Reagan and of the Reagan administration, the Reagan administration was among the first, at least in the 20th century, to specifically have a test, an ideological test for those who were going to be appointed to the federal courts, not just the Supreme Court, but the appellate courts as well. And so you had candidates who were being interviewed specifically about their political and their ideological interests. Now, one looks back at the appointments to courts, of course, presidents always wanted to appoint somebody who might be sympathetic to their political outlooks. And that was always true. But at the same time, they did not make it so much of a party issue, and certainly not even of an ideological one. So you have, for example, Herbert Hoover appoints Cardoza, who was a Democrat, to the court on the grounds that he was the best person, or that most of people in the business and the profession thought would be was available. Eisenhower appoints another very important Democrat, Brennan, to the court, and he specifically wanted a Democrat on the court. There was, in other words, this sense of fairness that was attached to the appointments. The Reagan administration is really quite different than that. Although Nixon, to some degree, had already altered the groundwork on that, the Reagan administration is the real change, and that has persisted for the last 30 years. So, yes, that's been an important part of the swing to the right and toward big businesses' interests, not just businesses' interests, but big businesses' interests.
One of the reasons why I think it is so important is because it's become the rhetoric of the right, especially with the Tea Party movement, this anti-taxation thing, without understanding what has actually happened with the public financing.
Well, I think that there's a much broader reason for the appeal of the tax issue to ordinary Americans, why they seem to be beguiled by the notion of tax cuts. And I think there's been a very dramatic sea change in American attitudes, in the American mentality, which I do attribute to two things. One is the, of course, shift in the development of American economic growth in the 1970s, where in the immediate post-war decades, you had tremendous economic growth and a tremendous spread in affluence in the country, including a reduction in inequality. And then you have the 1970s, which all of a sudden, things changed. And the country went into stagflation, and economic opportunity seemed to be shrinking exactly at the time that the baby boomers are coming of age and flooding into politics, into the economic arena, into business, and into education. It's exactly that time. They're coming off their own experience of having a pretty good life and looking forward to still a better life in the future. But now what they're facing is tremendous competition from their cohorts, at a time when the economic environment has turned sour. And in addition, they now have to face competition from those groups in the United States that had been severely discriminated against, including women and minorities. They're now vying for exactly the same kind of posts as the white males of the baby boomers. And so you have now an environment that indeed gives rise to the dubbing of the 1970s as the me decade. And you have now, instead of the kind of generosity that characterized the previous two or three decades, now what you have is a very sour, very self-oriented, me-first kind of generation. And I think that's one of the things that has persisted.
This is Paul Pearson. Could I just jump in on this one point?
Please.
Because I guess I would just want to emphasize, in contrast with some of those last comments, that I do not think that public opinion is the main thing that's driving this at all. There, as you were saying, Maria, there's been a sharp shift in tax policy, which has really favored those at the very top of the income distribution. There's research by one of my Berkeley colleagues, Emmanuel Saez, that shows that over the last 30 years, the real tax rates that most Americans pay at the federal level have stayed very stable. The only group that they've really changed dramatically for are those people in the top 1% of the income distribution, and especially those at towards the top of that very top group. And for them, the rates that they pay in taxes have dropped really dramatically, even as their wealth and their incomes have gone up dramatically. So it's a really astonishing change. There's nothing in public opinion data, which I've studied very carefully on this issue, there is nothing to suggest that that is the outcome that the public favors. You know, even if you look at the fight over the extension of the Bush tax cuts, where the question was, are we going to extend all the Bush tax cuts or just those for the bottom 98% of the income distribution? And, of course, ultimately, Congress and the president agreed to extend them all, including, you know, huge tax breaks for people at the top of the income distribution. And the polling data was very clear while that debate was going on. Most Americans favored not extending the tax cuts for people at the top of the income distribution, and yet there was bipartisan agreement to do it anyway. So I don't believe that the main reason we're getting growing inequality and getting a growing business heft in American society and American politics is because public opinion shifted.
I don't think you're actually saying two different things in reality. And I remember, Richard Abrams, your testimony at the California State Senate where you talked about not just the wealthy taxes being reduced, but the corporate taxes being reduced, and now everything turning into fees. So now there are fees on everything, museums and zoos and parks, et cetera. So I think that what he's referencing is not that public opinion supports less taxes for the rich so much as that they don't understand it to that degree and are angry about just having to share the pot with all these other groups. Is that correct, Richard Abrams?
Yes, I'm not really disputing Pearson's argument about the, in some ways, the structural reasons for the success of the tax forces and the pro-corporation forces in Congress. I buy all of that. I'm grateful for the kind of research that Pearson has done. But what I am saying is that there has been a shift in mentality, which makes it possible for people to have maybe even contradictory views polls, you know, will lead you to all sorts of things. Yes, let's cut taxes, but let's not cut my services. Let's cut subsidies, but don't cut the subsidies for me. One has to understand that when put to the test with referenda, for example, you have such things as Proposition 13 in 1978 in California, which effectively has wrecked public services in California, and then that had an epidemic effect around the country. People don't like taxes, but particularly they don't like government, and there's a whole litany of reasons for that.
There are two things I'd like to get into this. One is that part of the effort, Scott Bowman, I think this was partly your work, was when the Business Roundtable organized, part of it was to change public opinion. And I'm wondering if perhaps this move in the mass media from more neutral public affairs and news programs to a very ideological kind of programming could be connected to this concerted effort by organized corporate interests. Does that seem logical?
I'm not sure that was really a plan, so to speak, but I think it's a function of the merger move more than anything else. It's the concentration of media that's given rise to relatively few companies that control vast conglomerates.
And also, I think the change in regulation, if you think about it, because they lifted the Fairness Doctrine.
Well, the Fairness Doctrine died a long time ago, but the real regulatory change came in 1996. But that was preceded by dramatic changes in mergers that really began with the Carter administration. But since 1996, media mergers have just completely gone off the charts in terms of size and number, and by leading to increasing concentration and fewer entities that actually provide the news, we no longer have that diversity of opinion that we might have had in the past. Now, there's a lot of arguments here that the Internet has actually provides diversity in a variety of ways, but when you're talking about the polarization of media in terms of political views, you can point to Fox News, for example, as actually politicizing news content to a large extent, and of course, other entities are responding as well to that. So I think that has a lot to do with concentration in media. And, of course, the political role of business has something to do with it, but I think it's more about corporate ownership at this point. I would add that that's the other major aspect. When we're talking about corporations and American democracy and politics, besides lobbying, besides campaign contributions, it's the effect on media, media's effect on politics, and the fact that public debate in some ways has been changed dramatically by corporate control.
And that would bring me to really a very, very key question. And Paul Pierce, I'm going to bring you in first. And that is, you know, there's a lot of talk about reform, about trying to restore democratic ideals and practices and to shrink the inequality that we're seeing. And people have talked about a lot of different ways to get there. One is labor movements, trying to reinvigorate labor. One is focusing on the legal aspect of it, like personhood, revocation of charters. Some say, no, we just need to go and regulate better. So when you think about restoring democratic ideals, political participation, political power, and equality, what would you say would be the most effective way to focus?
Well, Jacob and I actually give a pretty emphatic answer to that question in the book, which is that the critical thing to focus on is political organization. We think that an awful lot follows from that. And in some ways, that may be a way to explain at least the difference in emphasis between my comments before about public opinion and what Professor Abrams said, much of which I agree with. You know, there certainly is a lot of middle-class frustration and anger out there, quite understandably, given the economic developments of the last few decades, really, and how hard things have been for the middle class. The question is what to do with that anger and frustration and how to direct it. And this is where I think political organization becomes so crucial, and where conservatives and their business allies, I think, have been enormously successful in using their organizational advantages to channel that frustration in directions that are advantageous to them. It's really quite astonishing to see how an economic crisis that was generated by absolutely scandalous practices being followed in the financial industry that enriched a very small circle of people at the expense of everyone else led to a terrible economic downturn and really widespread unemployment. And somehow this is being channeled into an aggressive effort to cut government programs and, you know, identifying as the main scapegoats public sector workers. And there is just no evidence at all to suggest that the status of these workers has much at all to do with the circumstances that state governments are facing. So it's a tremendously clear example of how organizational resources are being used to push an agenda that will advantage certain economic interests in the United States at the expense of others.
When you say political organization, what should be the focus?
I think that defending unions is absolutely crucial. It is not an accident that conservatives are using their electoral victories to launch an aggressive attack on public sector unions. For them, it's a double whammy, right? It both gives them a scapegoat that distracts attention from the real problems in American politics and the American economy, and it gives them a chance to increase their power at the expense of the only, you know, substantial group that brings resources to bear in defense of middle class and working class interests on economic issues in American politics. And I don't want to say that unions never do anything wrong, because of course they do on occasion, and sometimes they push for things that produce narrow advantages rather than broad ones. But on every broad economic debate about how the resources of the American economy should be distributed, unions have been on the side of the vast majority of American citizens. So, you know, working to defend unions is crucial, and then expanding out from there to try to convince more Americans that organizing around economic issues is absolutely critical to provide some kind of counterweight to the kinds of forces that have been dominating American politics and policy over the last couple of decades, with disastrous effects for the rest of us.
Richard Abrams, if labor unions today were strengthened and they had political power like they might have once upon a time, what would be the key issue or issues you think they should focus on that would be structural issues that could impact this democracy and economic situation?
I don't know how to go about it. I mean, as either Paul or Bowman said earlier, I don't know that the Citizens United really makes all that much difference, because corporate America has always had a great deal of power, and they'd always have ways of getting around any limitations on their contributions to elections. I think it's symbolically important, because it has encouraged that sort of thing to unbelievable dimensions. But somehow or other, there has to be some kind of change in the degree to which the wealthy can buy their own legislators and buy their own court appointees, because that's basically what has been happening in the last 10 to 30 years.
Scott Bowman?
I don't have any quick solution. I was just thinking, when Professor Abrams was mentioning buying legislators, it seems that we're back in the era of plutocracy, like 100 years ago, during the Progressive Era. And the big argument then was that, in fact, the corporate moguls indeed did buy their legislators, and that led, of course, to some revisions in campaign financing, among other things. But not much has changed. I mean, we've gone through periods where labor did have considerable influence, I would say, in the 60s and 70s, but since the late 70s, it's been waning consistently. The real problem here is that the base of the labor movement has shrunk. I don't know the exact percentage, but I think it's gone from around 33% of American workers to less than 12% or something like that.
I think that's right. I think in the private sector, it's something like 7.8%.
And the key here is the public sector, because of what remains of the labor movement. Its revitalization, if it's occurred at all, has occurred in the public sector. And now when this money is being channeled to go after public sector workers, it's really kind of frightening for the future of the labor movement. By the way, the amount spent since Citizens United by individuals, and much of this, I suppose, has been aimed at this sort of attempt to change, particularly in Wisconsin. Just in the last election cycle, $294 million were spent. That is an increase over $68.9 million of this type of spending, and nearly half of that was spent from just 10 groups. And among those groups are the Koch brothers, and as well as two groups formed by Karl Rove. So it's pretty clear that people are seeing the opportunity to go after labor. I think what we need to do is we need to support labor, as Paul said. We need to do whatever we can to understand that it has a much broader political agenda than simply own its own narrow economic interests. That's been the case for quite some time. And we need to counteract this. We aren't going to have any change in campaign spending in the near future, but we need to do whatever we can to try and get some kind of new legislation passed that will allow people to run for office that simply and be able to compete with the wealthy and the corporate interests.
Paul Pearson, let me give you the last word.
It's been a great discussion. I think one thing that I would say at this point is we've seen this movie before, as the other speakers have commented. This is a long, long story, and if you go back to the end of the 19th, early 20th century, it looked in some ways like the situation that we're in now. And I think what people have to realize is that on the one hand, that means there's no easy way out. It's going to take time to turn things around, but it has been done before, and it took waves of reform over an extended period of time to create a system where there was more balance in the American economy and in American politics. I have to say, polls show yes, there certainly are individuals who are quoted in newspaper articles who sound like the individual that Professor Abrams was talking about, who don't want to see public sector workers having, you know, opportunities that they don't have. But the polling that I've seen suggests that most are pretty sympathetic to the union position on this issue. And in Madison, you had 100,000 people rallying at the Capitol in 17-degree weather in support of those unions. But I have to say, I think that for things to turn around organizationally, unions are going to be really important, but it's going to have to reach beyond unions because their level of penetration of the economy is so slight now that, you know, other Americans are going to have to figure out other ways to come together and recognize that the middle class vision that's been so central to this country for so long is really in dire, dire need of attention and correction if we're going to get things back on a more balanced course.
Great to have you all on the air here. Paul Pearson is professor of political science at UC Berkeley and author, co-author of both Off-Center, Winner Take All Politics, and Richard Abrams, professor of history at University of California, Berkeley, and author of America Transformed, and Scott Bowman, chairman of political science at Cal State Los Angeles and author of The Modern Corporation and American Political Thought, Law, Power, and Ideology. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Maria.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.